What's that sound? Oh my God!
Every spring is a spring.
In the house.
Igor Stravinsky once famously said,
Les artistes inférieurs empruntent, les grands artistes volent.
Or,
Lesser artists borrow, great artists steal.
And he certainly practiced what he preached.
Ah, oui?
Ah, over the course of his lifetime, the sticky-fingered maestro was known to have filched more than 400 batons.
440 batons.
A dozen tubas.
A dozen de tubas.
58 tuba mouthpieces.
58 tuba embouchures.
8 books on tuba ligation.
8 livres on the tuba ligation American thing.
The grand staircase. Oh dear. The grand
I give up now.
Okay. The grand staircase of that Paris opera house.
Twice, deuxième fois.
Plus Richard Strauss, whom he held for ransom for a week. Historical footnote. Stravinsky never collected a penny. Strauss's unremitting dourness prompted Stravinsky to return his rival well ahead of schedule. On the other hand, the ordeal gave Strauss the inspiration for his opera, Der Muffig Russe, or The Smelly Russian.
The Smelly Russian?
Oh, oui.
Der Muffig Russe.
Yeah.
I can do the German.
Before it could be performed, however, Strauss died under mysterious circumstances involving a tuba. In the years that followed, scores of non-pop composers have taken to heart Stravinsky's dictum. Whenever feasible, we pilfer an idea from somewhere or somebody else. Wholly original concepts are frowned upon.
Absolutely. I will not take a wholly original concept, nor invent it. I will only steal the concept. I will take it. I will pilfer. I will filch. And it's still no good.
Overly inventive composers are ostracized, sometimes even killed. This is because we wrote the book about 21st century audience, or at least colored in some of the pictures.
Yes, I have done that. In the lines? No, I was... I cut off Santa Claus's beard once. We had to do the, the fill in the pictures, and then you cut out the thing in the page. And I was following the line so carefully, I cut right around the face, and I had a Santa with no beard left.
What color was his beard?
I don't remember the color. All I remember is the color of my knuckles, because I used the hickory block back then in the school I went.
Why did the French suddenly turn into an Italian accent?
I don't know. I was getting hit, man. What can I tell you? All right, where was
I don't know. We know, for instance, that listeners are assailed by information of all kinds from every conceivable direction, as well as some that are inconceivable. These willing spectators need their auditory diversions to be transparent, not obfuscatory. According to data from a famous statistical clearinghouse, and if I mentioned its name, you'd recognize it in an instant, audience fancy a recognizable melody, harmony, rhythm, timbre, or sonic fulmination more than they do snakes on a plane, by a whopping margin of 6
degrees of separation.
Otherwise, they're prone to bouts of melancholy and resentment.
And dourness.
Yes, this is true for the snakes, too. Take, for example, Muzak.
You take Muzak.
No, you take it.
Oh, I won't. I won't steal it.
Oh, that bastion of business background music. For years, the company provided placid instrumental arrangements of popular music specially handcrafted for playing in shopping malls, public toilets, and above all, elevators. But recently, Muzak fiddled with its easy listen-in formula by injecting some original music into its repertoire. The result? Their customers abandoned them like rats deserting a sinking tuba. And last week, Muzak filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. Note, if you're reading this story after it has been posted online, that last sentence should read,
Vere dolet, qui sine musica dolet.
Or,
or
there.
Oh, footnote, star, asterisk, he mourns honestly who mourns without Muzak.
Stealing music is typically a solitary enterprise. However, there are occasions when it pays to have company. One urban composer, we'll call him Landini, had employed borrowed melodies in his tunes ever since he could pick up a nose flute. But he had only borrowed them. In Stravinsky's view, and indeed in the minds of two reviewers, who we will also call Landini, that made him a lesser artist. So he aimed his sights higher. He would steal his next musical idea. He figured he could just race up to another composer, grab a motif, rhythm, fulmination, or whatever, and dash off before his victim could react. The problem with this plan was that he was both smaller and much slower than his target tunesmith. So he persuaded another composer to help with the heist. Landini and his accomplice, who we'll also call Landini, and what are the odds of that happening?
Now, what are the odds of that happening?
Six.
Degrees of separation.
Exactly.
I see, of course.
They concealed themselves along the berm of Tin Pan Alley. When their quarry strolled by, they leapt out, forced him to the ground, commandeered the melody he had been humming, and escaped with only a touch of brucellosis. Landini put the tune to use at once, and Landini the critic, i.e. the first one, later praised it for being derivative.
True praise. Yes. That is what we like today. You know, most of our concert music today is derivative.
How's that?
What do you mean, how's that? That's exactly the truth. It must be. Don't you know the rules of the American Commission?
No tell.
10 minutes.
Yeah.
Done in two rehearsals.
Mm-hmm.
Completely audience accessible.
Yes.
And 100% derivative.
Oh, I didn't get that last 100%.
Yeah, that's a new rule. It was just enforced, you know, because the old rule wasn't working and they were actually getting interesting music.
Oh, they don't want that.
No more. So, all right, where we are. Ah.
Exactly. Turns out the victimized composer had lifted it from another composer who had engaged in similar purloinical activities of his own. On and on, all the way back to 1680, when Johannes Pachelbel's new pressure cooker malfunctioned. Before it blew up, it emitted 8 piercing squeals, which would become, once the composer's writing hand mended, the 2-measure ground bass to his D major canon.
Oh!
Can you do it?
Wah, 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 wah.
That's it. Do you call that cannon fodder?
It is certainly. It's well worth being some kind of fodder.
Yeah.
That you do. Did you ever listen to the NPR like 20 years ago did an entire I think it was Christmas Day where they played every available version of the Pachelbel cannon.
Oh dear.
I recorded the show. I couldn't believe it. It was like the absolute moment when I knew that was the end for NPR. From then on, it was like the station of George Winston classics forever.
There's a program on some NPR stations, not one that we get. It's called, what is it called?
What is it called?
It's
about what?
Bad music. Unlistenable music. And part of it was, there was an excerpt on one of the programs yesterday, and they played the Taco Bell canon.
Ooh.
Which had... someone
should
Google it.
I must find it. Yes, I'll find it. Yes, please Google that and send it to us right away.
Today, musical larceny is easier than ever. Countless banal ideas exist as internetlesome wave files, endlessly lapping against the shores of the cyber sea, just begging to be filch. This very radio show has supplied its share of pinchable material over the years, so the attentive composer should already be preparing to download samples from the acoustic events soon to follow
in the house.
Yes, our larceny is absolutely everywhere. We're very liberal with our musical larceny. We have very liberal larceny here on Calvus and Damon.
Okay, well, that may be applicable later on in the show.
Oh, okay.
Of course, before there was a house, there was a Calvus
ampersand
Damien's New Music Bazaar. During its 10.5-year existence, the proprietors interviewed scores of composers who attempted to be original, defying the very, very real needs of their audience. Many of them have since paid the price of their foolish vanity and are now dead, or worse, living in a dingy Tulsa walk-up with a broken pressure cooker while earning minimum wage mucking out whale barns. It's you we're speaking to.
You, yes, you we're speaking to you right
when we
now.
Stay.
I'm Billy Mays talking to you, and you're going to buy the... Oh, no, sorry. No, sorry, you don't have televisions. You don't know about Billy Mays.
I don't.
And ShamWow and the glue, the super glue kind of thing that he sells, the Hercules hooks and the... Yeah, he's selling a saw blade that goes in two directions at once now.
I feel like I'm missing.
He
so
got
much.
His start as a hawker on Atlantic City and the boardwalk.
He wasn't a Popeil man?
No, he wasn't. He was, well, for all of those people who are television watchers here, listening to our show instead of watching television, Billy Mays, yes, started on the boardwalk at Atlantic City. He is the perfect pitch man. And he now has like six houses, almost as many as John McCain had last year. Uh-huh. And he's very wealthy, and he's just like this sort of bearded doofus pitch man and makes millions.
He doesn't pitch his own products. He pitches other people's products.
No, he pitches only products, as he says in interviews, that he believes in.
Oh, good.
Like Hercules hooks.
Yeah, that would do it. It's you we're speaking to when
you,
we say...
It's you we're... Oh, sorry.
Stop.
I got carried away with that.
Stop trying to be so darned clever.
Yes.
Listen to Papa Igor.
Papa Igor.
Go steal a nice tune. Maybe add a Landini cadence to it. You'll feel a lot better.
I feel better just thinking about it.
As will your intended audience. Afterwards, you can boot up this chat with the tunesmith who has larceny on her mind, or at least in her name. Just be sure to wipe the ambergris off your boots before venturing
in the house.
You think anybody thought back from ambergris to the whale barn a few paragraphs earlier or a few sentences earlier?
That's the beauty of downloading this. One can just hit the rewind button.
The rewind on their button. Cassette yes, machine. That. On their cassette. On their 8-track. Oh, wait, that didn't
they
have a
rewind. No, you just had to switch tracks.
And fast forward.
That, again, was cassette.
All right, let's hear the rest of this tune and we'll get back to things. Yes, there's your filching music for you.
A nice tune for the cold, icy conditions.
Yes, that's a tune called Ice Cut in a new recording that is about to be released. So you've heard preview of part of it. Josh Pershbacker has done a recording of Ice Cut on an organ, a huge organ in Minneapolis, and that'll be coming out this summer.
Now, we know Ice Cut as a non-organic tune, that is.
Yeah, orchestral. Orchestral,
yeah.
Written for originally for the Vermont Symphony and played by them. And this is neat. And of course, this, speaking of larceny, this piece actually, and I've never admitted this to a general public, has a part of it stolen.
A general puppet?
Puppet, and I puppeted it, purloined the puppet right from...
You populated it?
Populated it by purloining the puppet from the piece that I presented previously. whose name I won't mention, but having to do with environmental awareness, and the solo violin line was so good in it, I liked it so much that I stole it and I threw it on the bottom and I made it the cello line. So that's Ice Cut. Mm-hmm. Where were we? Larceny.
We have a guest.
our guest today is in fact famed American composer, and we'll ask her about that. Libby Larson. And Libby Larson was in New York at the same time I was in New York, and several other people, including upcoming guest John Luther Adams, who we'll be interviewing soon. And Stephen Paulus wasn't there, but Elliot Schwartz, who's been on the show, he was there. Rob Patterson will be on the show this summer. He'll be live here in the studios. And he was there at the concert. He's, in fact, director of American Modern. And who else was on that program? My mind is just
John blank. Williams.
No, John Williams this time. It's going to be fun to listen to this interview because we were in the Times Center in New York in kind of a hallway below the stairs.
Not in the house.
It was out of the house. It was on the road. And it was pretty astounding because it was so loud around us that it sounds like we're at a giant party in kind of a washtub. it's really sort of astounding. So I think we should go to it.
I guess. Yes. Get out of the house.
Out of the house, on the road to the Times Center in New York with our guest, Libby Larson.
Thank you. It's Calvos and Damien's new music bazaar. Actually, Calvos and Damien in its new incarnation of In the House, Out of the House, On the Road once again. We haven't been on the road for a while, and we're happy to be on the road again. Our guest today is Libby Larson, who is a famous American composer, and that is my first question. How did you get so famous? I've read you have a fact on your website that tells everything anybody ever wants to know, so I'm stuck. I have to ask the questions that you don't get asked. So that's number one. How did you get so famous?
You know, I don't know. You know, I have no idea because I don't know what fame is and, you know, what it means. And I'm not sure it means anything, actually. But I can tell you that I just was required to write a grant proposal which summed up the last 30 years of my work. Uh-huh. And it had to get into 3 pages. And I just thought, well, that's ridiculous. But one of the things I wanted to do was to make a case for a composer who does not hold an academic position, which I, by choice, do not hold an academic position.
It's something we share.
Yes. Yeah. You don't either. That's right.
I don't
you
either, know. And I've been a freelancer, and we're both quite prolific, and I'll ask you that question later. But
good,
back to
good,
your story.
Good, because
yeah.
It's really important.
Yeah, yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And what I did is I needed to explain to them what it is to make a choice to live in the chasm, you know, for a composer, to make that choice. You don't hold an academic position. No, and you're not a commercial composer.
Yes.
So there's a chasm, and
yes.
That's where the best new work is happening. The most authentic work is happening in the chasm. But in order to explain myself, I took out a map of the United States, and I went state by state and remembered every residency and master class I've done. And it turns out that in every state in the Union except Alaska, you know, I over the past 30 years, I visited 3 or 4 times doing festivals or residencies or, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think what it is it's what we are as modern-day troubadours.
Mm-hmm.
Something, I don't know if you were prepared to be a troubadour.
I wasn't, no.
Neither was I.
And I mean, we are about approximately the same age, and we, I'm sure, both went through the kind of avant-garde modernist period of time in which we suspected that we would be groundbreaking artists that would change the world.
Yes.
In a way that happened in a different way than we ever expected at all.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Isn't that the truth? Yes. I thought, yeah, we were both in graduate school in the 70s. And at that point, musical language was in a very different place, mostly because we didn't have the kind of technology we have now.
Right, right.
You know, so people were still convinced that extending the 12 tones of the piano was the way to go.
Right,
you know, except for Varese, who is the true genius of the last century. And I thought, well, okay, that is a beautiful way to spend your intellectual life. You know, is working in that way, but I, like you, could see that sound itself. The biggest thing that happened to music in the last 100 years was sound.
Right.
Sound. And
exactly.
I thought, this is going to change everything. So I want to find a way to bridge it, you know, to bridge what I know will be with what was, and that is to get outside of the academy,
mm-hmm.
which is really about speculation or retrospection.
Mm-hmm.
And just work. Just work. And keep drawing in sound, the way sound works, as the culture's developing it, which is the chasm. And it takes you everywhere.
It takes you everywhere, but it also takes... Now, how do you keep your energy?
Oh, what a great question. I work very hard on stamina, and I bet you do too. So I want to ask you that question. But I took up marathon running about 22 years ago, and I run. I'm a runner.
You're a runner.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And it gives me buckets and buckets of energy. What do you do? Because you're so energetic.
I live in Vermont. No, you live in the North Country too. But
yeah.
No, I had done until recent years hiking in the Grand Canyon. Long hikes, 100-mile hikes with my wife, and she's a midwife, and so we both have professions that are not highly regarded in America.
Oh, yes, of course.
Composer and midwife.
Yeah.
You know, we went to Europe and we spent time there. That gave us energy, both of us.
Oh, yes.
Because it wasn't so much we didn't get performances, she didn't get work, but we got respect.
Yes, I understand
something
that.
We did not sense in America, which at that point in our lives, which was 20 years ago, was very important to have happen.
I completely agree with you. And in fact, I've been thinking instinctually lately, trying to understand why I did the things I did 30 years ago, because I had to write the summary.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Yeah. It's like writing your own obituary. It's
yeah.
Very weird.
Oh, yeah. Let's do that now.
Yeah, let's do it. You know, I was thinking about the American Composers Forum, which in the early 70s was the Minnesota Composers Forum,
yes.
Which I co-founded. But I wanted to figure out, why did I do that? You know, what was that about? It wasn't about fame, and
right.
It wasn't about competition.
Right.
And it wasn't about career building.
Yes.
You know, it was about getting respect for the kind of abstract intellectual work that those of us who make sound go in order in time and space, which we call composing.
Right.
Or songwriting or jazz or, you know, what have you. But there's no respect for it in our culture.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it's a higher form of mathematics mm-hmm. than the rocket scientists.
In a lot of ways,
in
that's
a lot
true.
Of ways it is.
And it's so hard. Now, that's the thing that has always been very difficult to convey, is the amount of work that's involved.
Yeah, absolutely. Have you ever thought that what we do was born in the monasteries?
Yes, that's true.
A monastic kind of time where time is completely focused and completely protected. No, that's where notation, the kind of notation that we've evolved.
Pneumatic notation with the little symbols to remind us.
Yes.
And then the perrotins and their amazing melismatic
yes.
composition
yes.
and the fact that it was preserved and we have a lens into that era.
Yes, yes. And I thought, I'm right now orchestrating a 3-hour opera. and I see you smiling. You know what this means.
We have, yes, we'll talk after.
Yeah, yes. You know, this means 14 hours a day alone, you know, with every character and every bit of the orchestration and every hall in the world in my head.
Mm-hmm.
You know, pulling out the orchestra and just writing it down. I need a battalion of monks.
Yes, exactly.
Just before we started the conversation with Libby Larson, you heard Song Without Words. And now we'll listen to a little bit of Langston's Lot, numbers 1, 3, and 7.
I've seen it more. When I get to be a composer, I'm gonna write me some songs about daybreak in Alabama. And I'm gonna put the prettiest songs in it, rising out of the ground like a swan. Falling out of heaven like a soft dew. I'm gonna put some tall trees in it, and the scent of pine needles, and the smell of red clay after rain. Black people. And I'm gonna put one.
natural as dew. In the dawn of music, in the dawn of music, when I get to be a composer and write about daybreak in Alabama.
That was Langston's Lot by our guest today on Calvus and Damien in the House, Libby Larson. That was numbers 1, 3, and 7. Now back to the Times Center in New York with our interview.
I need a battalion of monks.
Yes, exactly.
But in our culture, this doesn't exist. And not only does it not exist, the computer programs are much slower. They are so slow.
In a lot of respects, they are. I mean, I use them because I'm very fast with them.
Yes.
I've gotten fluid with them as I've shifted from paper to whatever is notationally proper for one of these pieces of software, I will do in the software.
Yeah.
Everything else I will do on paper and then do this design, as it were, the
visual
design.
Right, it's graphic design. Yeah.
The advantage to me, of course, is no repetition. I don't have to do it again when I make changes in the middle.
Right. And I went a different route. I just got two or three copyists who really know the programs.
There you go.
They know, and I've been working with them for years and years, you know, so they translate. However, back to the monastic art form and the beautiful, the shaping of neumes and beams and note heads and what we do on paper. You know. Lately, I've been trying an experiment. I've been asking chamber ensembles, would they rather have the score computer notation or hand notation? And to a person, they want hand notation.
It's very interesting.
If you know, if you have beautiful writing, they don't want the parts. Parts, absolutely computerized. Mm-hmm. You know, standardized size of note heads. But the score, they much rather see the composer's personality come through the hand.
The architecture shows. And I have to admit that there's one thing about the notation done in software that I do miss, and that's that architecture.
Yeah.
Pieces that require the architecture I do on paper because of that.
I transfer
them to the software because I'm quite good at the software and can do amazing things with it. I'm a copyist for other people. So I copy for other composers.
Yes. And you've told me this before.
I got a lot of experience in doing that. So when it comes to my own piece, I turn into a copyist head.
Oh,
a different approach.
Interesting.
And so I have to say, how do I express this composer, who happens to be me, coincidentally, that personality in this score?
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so
that's,
if it's a different role I take.
Yeah, that's really interesting. It'd be like being your own editor.
Yes, which is really hard.
Yeah. Back to opera, right? Back to opera.
So we're back to the personality of the rooms and how the people want to see that score, want to see your personality in that score.
Right, yeah. which ties in with what we've been talking about in terms of the dignity and respect for what it is that we actually do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that we, because you and I are trained and our colleagues are trained, you know, in this terribly abstract but vitally human essential activity of the brain. You know, music is the activity of the brain that integrates the three survival languages. You know, nobody talks about that, but except the brain researchers.
Yes.
And it is, and we are specialists in that area. Yep. Yet we live in a culture which, by and large, views the products of what we do in a commodified way, rather than in it'd be like if you bought a 6-pack of math formulas.
But hasn't commodification, in some respects, helped you? Not as a composer, but as a composer who gets performances.
Yes. Yes, I think it has.
And how do you handle that sort of psychological disconnect, if there is one?
There, lately, I when I give a talk or a master class, I go out of my way to tell people that there are no instruments available in the world today that can realize what it is I hear in my head. You're smiling again.
I'm smiling because I read your talk to the music educators.
It's so much fun to talk with you. It is true. That is true. And I'm sure that you have sounds in your head for which there are no instruments.
That's right. I've built instruments to do that, physically built instruments. And so
we
both do that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But the reason I went back, I mentioned that talk in which you talk about these sort of these integrations is sort of you had something in mind when you gave this talk.
Yeah.
And my question is, how is that going? In education, have we seen an accommodation of a change from sort of a notationally constricted thinking to a sonic thinking? Is that happening?
Right now, it's happening more in idea than it is in practice. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of interest in the idea, but there's not much practice in the idea. I'm about to go give another talk at a music educators conference, you know, and it, music education, oh boy, we could talk for weeks and weeks about this.
Yeah.
But the word commodify, which we're talking about, commodification really took hold of music education in the early 1970s. Big time. I would even go so far as to say a stranglehold.
Mm-hmm. Are we talking about, you know, the sales of sort of kits of ORF?
Yes, we're talking about, about kits, methodologies.
Yes.
We're talking about choir robes.
Yeah.
We're talking about instrument cases, you know, mm-hmm. the selling of things around making music, but only a very narrow kind of music. And in fact, that music itself has become its own kind of music, which is educational music.
Uh-huh.
And it's widely acknowledged among composers, but more importantly, among music teachers, that the music is not good. By and large, the music of music education, you know, it is not good music. It's music that is written to practice solving a music education problem.
You know, that's really interesting.
And it is true, you know, it's true. And the problem is then it's prescribed, and the creativity, you know, that makes music breathe and live, is what's challenged mm-hmm. when you're writing educational music. So, through the American Composers Forum, we've for a long time been trying to address at the middle school band level. This question of how do we bring creativity, you know, and find compositional, really a standard of composition, not peacemaking, you know.
Well, now this is interesting because I'm going to divert you again here because I have heard you interviewed other times
mm-hmm.
and read things that you've written, and I suspect that you are one of the most highly disciplined people that you know.
Maybe.
And
why,
you expect
why are you saying
that?
This?
Because you're talking about the standard of composition.
Oh,
and that,
okay.
That you have an incredible standard that you expect and enthuse in others.
I hope so.
And is that effective in the long term, or do you think that when you're out of the picture, it fades back to where it was?
If I have an audience, which I will have next week, mm-hmm. of mm-hmm. music educators who are dedicated to music education,
right.
and I can enthuse even one of them to carry it on, you know, to carry on beyond what's just, the word just escaped me, but music educators are overloaded with their own work.
Yes.
They've given themselves so much work to do that they don't have time to think about music. You know? Which makes me think there's an insecurity or a fear somewhere. Fear-based. You know, I don't know what it is, but I suspect that it's probably as simple as there really is no time in public music school education as there has never been time. No. To globally do what music educators wish they could do, you know, Because music is infinite. You and I, all we are is we are a moment suspended in infinity. And music flows through our brains.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, so we sometimes also get a very sort of a worldview that's based on that, which is very a very strange view in other people's opinions of us.
Yeah, it's true.
Why don't you just entertain me, please?
Right, exactly, exactly. We really are moments in infinity. Music is what's infinite.
Yeah.
It's not people.
Yeah.
Yet our culture, back to commodity.
Yes.
You know, we are culturized to think that we can own music, systematize it, and own that system. Systematize a way of teaching it, and not only own that system, but inculcate that system as the definition of music. You know, and music education, I am very disciplined. You know, if I'm going to say something like this, I better be able to back it up.
Yes.
You know, and so I really, really have researched hard, you know, where our notions of music education came from and where they stopped growing, because they did stop growing. No. Now, and music education was really predicated on a certain philosophy that's called the philosophy of the ideal citizen, which was very much part of the forming of our public school systems in the late 1800s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that to be an ideal citizen and matriculate publicly, you know, music was part of what made you an ideal citizen. Its goal was not performance. No, performance was part of its practice.
Huh.
But the goal was not performance.
Yeah.
And somewhere in the last 100 years, we have morphed the definition of a musician to mean only a performer. Whereas 150 years ago, if you were only a performer of music, you were not considered a musician.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think I've gotten off your question. But when I go to a music educators convention and speak directly with, they're really not my colleagues because I don't have a music education degree, nor would I ever want one. No, but I say that I don't have a music education degree. I'm skating on thin ice, you know. But what I want to do is I want to help them come away from that fear of music itself, because I think that's what's at the bottom of it. You love something so much, and you're so afraid that you can't transmit it.
We have, I think, a general fear, though, don't we, that we are not grounded enough in our discipline because it's so big.
Yes.
Like, don't hand me a pop piece and expect me to do anything with it.
Exactly.
I can't.
No.
But on the other hand, we have a full generation of music educators who have not been given a grounding in what Calvus and Damien call non-pop.
Yeah, that's true.
And I wonder if part of that fear comes from a simple lack of knowledge.
I think you're a brilliant man. Yes. When I've studied music education curriculums, one of my little hobbies as I go around and do residencies is to see how music education is taught at the various institutions where I work. And what I'm seeing in general, with some notable, wonderful exceptions, is that the kids who, they love music and they want to live their lives through music and they want to teach music. And the curriculums that they're given, unless they stumble on a very gifted teacher, the system itself doesn't actually teach them much about music. They're afraid of theory, by and large. I always ask, who's afraid of theory? And everybody raises their hand.
Absolutely.
You know, and I just think, oh my goodness, you know.
And after this many years of being a composer, I'm afraid of theory too.
Yeah.
Because I no longer can go back to it and see it in a way that it's simple enough to describe in generic terms. And rather, that this piece has a theory, that piece has a theory, that piece has a theory.
They all have theories.
Yeah.
They all have theories. And it's just a way into the, but you know, the kids, often I get to, I'm hosted by the local chapter of SAI or FIMU, which is also a really wonderful kind of focus and control group. So I asked them, you know, and this is what's great about being a troubadour composer, because you're really on the streets and you hear what people are thinking. But anyway, the kids tell me, the music education kids are by and large terribly frustrated. And the reason they're frustrated is that they are asked to take so many classes in